Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 comics sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. In this episode, we're going to be talking about the top comic sales for October 2019 is sold through Diamond to retailers in North America. This is what sells into stores, not what's sold to us readers, because, well, that's the numbers they report on. And joining me tonight is Sam. How you doing tonight, Sam?
I'm doing well, John.
Good. And then we've also got Eric from Cowabunga. How you doing tonight, Eric?
I'm doing great, and it's awesome to be here with you guys. We've already had some spirited discussion before we even got into the numbers, so I'm pretty excited about how this is going to go.
Oh yeah, tons of interesting stuff. A lot of data. When we talk about the breakdown, we're going to limit it to the top 300 because we've got that going back to February 2003. We do have the top 500 for the comics. We can go a little deeper if we want to over there. Looking at that breakdown, we've got what about 14 or so publishers on the list. Unsurprisingly, at the top of that with the largest chunk of the units is Marvel with 50.37% of the units. That works out to just over 4 million units. Actually, 4,009,905 units. So they did well. Gee, go figure. Behind them is DC with 35.19% of the units. So that's a gap of a little over 15%. So pretty significant there. And then in third place is Image with 6.05%, followed by the other premier publishers of IDW, Boom, Dynamite, and Dark Horse. If we look at this by dollars, of course, things skew a little differently based on the average cover price. Marvel is at 49.79% of the total retail dollars for the top 300 comics, so just under 50%. DC at 36.56%, so the gap narrows a little, but really not by much between those two. And then by dollars, Image is down at 5.95%. So this month, it didn't make that big of a shift on the comic side when you look at it by dollars. And again, at one point, it makes sense to look by units because, hey, who's selling more comics? On the other hand, you actually make money by, you know, making money. Where this is important to keep in mind, though, is we're looking at retail dollars on this, not the invoice dollars. Different stores, different discounts, and it could be a pretty wide difference between like that minimal, 35% or that maximum of, I think it's like 59% or whatever discount that a store could have. One new publisher we do have on the breakdown this time around is Ablaze. They had two items on the list, and I think those were their first two items, which was, or maybe they were on last time, I forget. It was Vampire State Building. I think that was their first title.
Yeah, that was.
So,
and that was nice. Actually a pretty solid launch too. It was a good book. Good read.
Yeah. I've heard good things about it. Didn't get it myself, but nice to see a new publisher, coming out, with some decent numbers.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, ahead of Oni, Titan, Valiant, I mean, they are the top non-premier publisher on the list this month.
Yeah. And it's funny because we've seen in the past one or two times, well, one time that I can think of, a new publisher actually top the top 300 list.
Yeah.
And that was Dreamwave when they first did Transformers, I think it was. So it's possible to launch really, really big. It's just kind of hard to do that, obviously.
John, I got a quick question for you. As we look at this chart and it says new items, we have Marvel at 108, DC is at 102. Now, I put all these things out on a table and I can tell you that there was not 102 unique titles to DC. Is that counting the different price levels as a new item because it ends up as a different line item in the top comics list?
Yes, it probably is.
Okay, so it's a skewed number.
It's a skewed number. I've started to adapt my system to the shenanigans they're doing, but man, it's a losing battle at times. There are a couple of things that, because the cardstock covers and those things, the different price points are, they're commonplace. We've got a few dozen items per month now for the last couple. I just need to find the time to figure out where and how to rework the system. And honestly, fixing that number hadn't occurred to me. I do label these as new items, reorder items, or total items. And that is literally line items on the list, not unique issues.
Yep. I kind of figured that much. I just thought it'd be good to know because I've seen and heard a few other podcasts and news outlets talking about DC catching up to Marvel as far as output. And again, as we say with anything, you know, data, whether it's right or wrong in the hands of the wrong person or just the wrong description, can be misleading. And this is definitely a case where I think the data is misleading.
Yeah, I think it's easy to misread this and think it is issues when, again, I try to label it pretty clearly, but it's easy to get confused on that, absolutely. And that's something that has come up over the years of people will look at either my article or Milton's over at ICV2 or John Jackson Miller's over at Comicron and think that they're suddenly experts in all of this stuff. And it's easy to misunderstand what this data is actually representing. You know, again, this is what sells into stores. We're looking at, you know, in some cases, an antiquated viewpoint on this because the system that is used to report these numbers was generated back in, man, I want to say the early 80s by Milton over at Capital City and stuff. And that was before we had really before cover shenanigans existed, before the various price points existed, before, you know, a lot of very commonplace current trends, which are ubiquitous now, were even thought of. And I think if somebody were to look at how the state of the industry is now and say, well, what would be a good way to represent this data and put the sales data out there, I kind of suspect what we've got isn't what they would come up with. You know, I think there's got to be a cleaner, better way. It's just we've got what we've got, you know?
And when you've got, you know, one company that's basically collecting the lion's share of the data and providing it as a distributor, that's different than a third party who's tracking via a sales front mechanism or something like that.
Well, and when you've got a third party doing it, they have different concerns than, again, Diamond, who is the distributor, who wants to reveal some information but not too much information. They may have contractual issues and stuff like that. So yeah, you've always got to keep in mind not only what data is being presented, but who's presenting it and why are they presenting it.
Well, and I think that is the biggest question. Why are they presenting it? And arguably, Diamond's doing this out of habit.
I would agree with that. I think they are doing it partially out of habit, partially out of the need, perceived need for comics to have something akin to TV ratings or movie box office stuff to generate the hype on this is a top seller and it sold out or those sorts of things. Because from a business perspective, I don't know these days that there's much need for Diamond to release this data.
Not only that, no one's paying for it. Arguably, there's 3-4 of you guys that do this and have been doing it for a long time. I don't know how much you or particularly John and Milton do with it as far as selling their services. But ultimately, I mean, when you look at things like TV ratings, the reason those numbers exist is there are advertisers that pay big bucks for them.
Yeah.
There's, you know, and I've lamented this for over a decade now. The amount of advertising in comics is down to near zero.
Yeah, it's almost all house ads and maybe two or three others and stuff. But yeah, the need for using it for advertising stuff, gone. And I don't think it was ever used for that.
No, my understanding is what the data was there for was a tool for retailers. It was actually a tool that Diamond kind of came up with to present to retailers in hopes that seeing the numbers would increase sales into stores. So if you were looking at your order, comparing it on a magnitude to the entire industry, and you went, oh, geez, you know, we underordered by percentage compared to everything else, we should up that. It was really Diamond's way of, one, providing the service for you to see how you sit, but then number two, hoping that it would kind of bump your sales a little.
That's essentially correct with one tweak. It was actually Capital City who first came up with it.
Granted, yes.
So, and that predates even Diamond existing by a good couple of years. But I was actually working at a store in the San Diego suburbs, and that's exactly what the store owner used it for. I would work on the weekends. He'd be sitting there trying to figure out his order. And that was back when you literally had the paper order form, and you just filled it out, handed that back in. And it was, you know, the old days where you want to know how much you sold. You go over, count how many are left. You know how many you ordered. Okay, here's how it's doing. Do I want to increase it, decreases? How is it doing versus the national average? Wow, other people are doing really well with this title. It's not moving for me. Do I not have enough? Do I need to order more? Is it just not applicable for my store? So absolutely, it was geared as that kind of sales tool back in the day when the most sophisticated equipment you had for putting together your order was one of those solar desktop calculators, you know?
Well, and I think that's the point to mention all the work that John puts into this. As far as the units, the retail dollars, all of that stuff, John creates, because you still get an index list.
Yeah.
And you've got to put all the time and effort and math into figuring all the rest of that stuff out.
The data that comes from Diamond has like 7 columns, I think, on it. And give me just a second. I'll actually pull up so I can reference it, the raw data. It is surprisingly sparse. And just a sec to pull that up so I can talk accurately on this. Okay, so it comes in currently Excel formats. It used to be just text files and whatnot. The columns it provides are the quantity rank, the retail rank, the index, the item codes, the description, suggested retail price, and the vendor name. That's it. So I've got, again, that index point. I've got to go turn that into the units, multiply that out by the dollar, the price to get the extended dollars and such, do the math to figure out how much it increased or decreased from last month, handle the fact it could be on there multiple times if it's at the different price points, all that kind of stuff. So I take those, what, 6 or 7 columns, and I mean, you guys have seen my spreadsheet. It's not something I've publicly released, and it's got, you know, how many different columns on it. It goes over 61. Quite a ways. Yeah.
Right, because you also add in all of the, you know, previews data, master data file information, which is what gives us the breakdown of creative talent and, you know, the artists and the writers, and we can start to see that too, albeit it's kind of a loose list of things based on the data you get, but that's all part of it, and that's not included in your initial package, and therefore it's a heavy lift. It's an absolutely heavy lift, and it's pretty impressive that you've put it together.
Well, and also, when was it expected to ship? When did it ship? How many weeks since the last release?
Yep.
How many variant covers it's got? Is it a new title? And is it, you know, non-series?
We should have added a new column. How many times has it been canceled and resolicited? Because Doomsday Clock.
There are a couple. Yeah, that kind of a thing.
Or how many times was the projected release date bumped out? Cal Exit.
One of the things I've been working on in my proverbial spare time is revamping how I do the title status of the new, the non-series, the annual special. Is it up in sales, down in sales type stuff to better handle some of the, well, it was solicited, unsolicited, and resolicited. You know, it's like, well, damn it, you know? Or again, it was pushed back multiple times. Like there have been issues of Doomsday Clock that got delayed, what, 7 or 8 times?
Right.
You know, and then it's like, what was that original expected date, the most recent expected date, and when did it actually ship? And on the one hand, for some people, it's, ah, who cares? It comes when it comes. Yeah, but there is some aspect of the number of weeks late it is or the number of weeks since the last issue can impact how it sells. Now, in some cases, it doesn't impact it at all. The next issue of Doomsday Clock is going to sell well because people are interested in the story. Other titles, you have that kind of a delay, you have killed sales. So yeah. I try to add value when I do the number crunching.
Interestingly enough, speaking of Doomsday Clock, it was fun listening to you and TJ talk about the trades. It just so happens on the day we're recording is the day that episode released. And so I was able to listen to it driving home today. And you guys talking about how you were surprised that Doomsday Clock did so well on the trade side. You're like, who would? And I'm like, you know what? The fact that I know it's almost, because I'm one of the people that read it. And I remember Eric kind of said the same thing. As a retailer, he wasn't really planning on ordering it because of the delays and the fact that it was only half of it, et cetera, et cetera. That being said, I read it and really enjoyed it.
I guess for me, the fact that they released the collection of the first 6, I think it came out around when issue 11 came out. It's like, that just seems late in the game.
Well, no, but there'll be another one that'll be the other half. And since assuming 12 comes out within the next month or two, you know, within 5-6 months, we'll have the second half. And, you know, waiting 5 months for 2 halves is better than waiting 2.5 years for 12 parts.
I guess my point was, it's very different than what Kirkman did early on with The Walking Dead, where you could use the trade to catch up and then almost immediately flip to the next issue.
Yeah.
But, or only be an issue or two behind and transition over.
But at this point, we kind of all know how late it is, or whatever. You get the one, you assume you'll get the second one relatively quickly, and then you just have the 2 parts.
But they also could have released it around the time issue 8 had come out and then had sales of this collection for the last, you know, what, 3 years? I mean, probably 6 months, but still.
Yes.
It just, the timing on that just seemed strange. Shall we jump over to the top list itself?
Let's do it.
A couple of things at the top I don't think are going to surprise anybody. Number one item was the new X-Men number one. 255,724 units. Dawn of X is launching strong off of Powers of X, House of X, which, coincidentally, the last issues of those are at ranks 3 and 4 at 160,845 units for Powers of X number 6, 158,396 units for House of X number 6. So these things ended strong, giving, again, a good launch pad for X-Men number 1, as well as Marauders number 1, which is at rank number 10 with 86,830, and Excalibur number 1 with 83,023 units down at rank number 12. We'll get the other first issues and I think the second issues of these in next month's numbers. So I don't think anyone should be unhappy with how the Dawn of X titles have launched, and obviously Powers of X, House of X just did gangbusters.
Yep.
Hidden there at rank number 2 is Spawn number 301. 186,031 units. That's down 81,924, but still crazy high. And again, this, I think, goes back to all of the promotional push on how it is breaking the run of Cerebus and stuff like that. And, you know, on the one hand, hey, this is the first Image title to hit 300 issues and surpass that. Good on McFarlane. He should definitely be congratulated with that. Equating that to the run on Cerebus, to me, is a little off because I really don't think McFarlane was involved in every issue of Spawn. Doesn't make it any less of an achievement. It just makes it a slightly different type of achievement.
Until the last 30, I think Todd wrote all of them.
I don't. Didn't he let, what was it? Who wrote the issues that had, some of the earlier ones that had the character that they've brought into the Marvel Universe, Angela, or whatever.
Well, yes, there's that run in the teens where there was a couple of guest writers. Matter of fact, it's funny you mentioned Dave Sim wrote one of them himself.
Yeah.
Because Cerebus was in one of them. Yes, there are those issues in the teens, but basically 1 to 250 minus those couple of guest issues with those guest stars, he wrote most of them.
Okay. All right, then maybe he did more of it than I was realizing.
And what was I going to say about the... you're thinking of the Sandman guy.
Yeah.
Neil Gaiman?
Neil Gaiman wrote that. Didn't he write that issue?
Yeah.
I think, well, so.
Even in the 100s, there was a lot of... there's a lot of books that Todd was listed as a writer, but there was usually two, maybe three writers on them. Brian Holguin gets writing credit for a ton of them. So, yeah, I mean...
Either way, it's the longest-running Image title, I would say, by a wide margin, because I think the next highest is Savage Dragon, which is almost at 250. So the fact that McFarlane, whether he's written them all, been drawing on some of them, whatever, you know, the fact he's kept the thing going successfully for this long is to his credit.
Right.
This is one of those where, again, while we had a 30% drop on this, I'm expecting a pretty massive drop on the next as it kind of falls back to its regular sales level.
Yep. I believe 302 does not have the 1 in 25. The 301 had a 1 in 25 variant, and the 300 had a 1 in 25 and a 1 in 50. So it would make sense that just those numbers alone, we would start to see a little bit of a decline.
Yeah, well, and a lot of people are there for the, oh, wow, it's still around, it hit this issue. You know, they're curious, they'll check it out. But then, you know, they'll move on to the next thing that hits their fancy.
Correct.
I mean, to me, that's the unfortunate thing about the comics audience is even if you've got something that's really good and you've got a way to kind of entice people to sample an issue, the return rate on that is so low usually that the bump you get just doesn't last. And let's face it, they've got some marketing people at these companies over the decades that have come out with some brilliant ideas for shenanigans to get sales on a particular issue to just shoot through the roof. You know, either it's a crossover, a character death, or a cover gimmick, or one of my personal favorites was the various Green Lantern Corps rings for Blackest Night and stuff. I mean, that was something that got sales to like four or five times what they had been for those issues that had the plastic rings. But, you know, if people are getting the ring and hopefully they're flipping through the issue, there's the opportunity, and granted, it's really hard to capitalize those, but there's the opportunity to actually get somebody who samples the book to say, wow, I ought to be reading this, and get some percentage conversion into regular readers. And let's face it, when you're taking your sales and multiplying by 4 or 5 in that kind of an instance, even if you had like a 2% conversion rate, you're going to notice it. You know, it's the same thing we saw with, I think it was the Civil War crossovers, the first Civil War one over at Marvel, where those crossover issues just shot through the roof. Afterwards, the title goes back to where it regularly sells. So I think people are willing to sample. They're just rarely willing to get on board a title. I think whoever can figure out how to kind of get around that has a major competitive advantage over the other publishers. So we'll see if anyone ever figures that out. Let's see. What else do we got up in the top of the list? We've got The Joker Year of the Villain, number one, 128,632 units. Pretty sure that's a one-shot, so not going to see those moving forward. Although there's a few other Year of the Villain, you know, one-shots, and frankly, quite a few other Joker things right now. Gee, go figure with the movie and such. And then we've also got Absolute Carnage, number four, doing just under 100,000 with 99,707 units. Obviously, that storyline's successful for Marvel.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that what Donny Cates has done with it and how it's tying back into Venom is just absolutely awesome. How it's going out and grabbing the codexes, and now with the last issue of Venom, Venom number 20, there's a twist with the codex that, I don't want to give it away. But yes, he has really architected a really cool storyline. It has managed to pull and fairly decently sustain good numbers across it, at least in our store. And it's something that folks continue to come in asking for well after it's launched, and now it's wrapping up. So yeah, this was definitely a big winner, as were the X titles, the Powers and House of. So,
well, it sounds like Cates was able to leverage the kind of storyline event, whatever you want to call it, as a way to get people more interested in the material and then back into those other books afterwards, not just they're here for the story and then they're gone.
Yep. Yeah. And this, I have a hunch that this will be a fairly decent selling collection when it's put together. I think that it's going to be one of those things where there's enough people that enjoyed getting the issues. Maybe they just got the main line that they're going to buy it in collected form. So I think that'll be really interesting to see.
Cool.
But I actually have a question for you, and it came up when I think it was the previews, might have been the previews episode, and it was the talk about how all of the new X launch titles, all the number ones, are in a collected edition. Now, I'm behind on my reading, and I haven't touched any of those new X titles, the Marauders, Excalibur, New Mutants, any of those. Is there connective tissue across those? And what I'm getting at with that is, would this be a case where Marvel tries something where here's the number ones, the next volume is the number twos, the next volume is the number threes? Not saying it's a good idea, but is there a connection to them, or is it just that they're all kind of fresh number ones at the time and just put out a book to try and get everyone into it?
There's definitely connections across. It's not like an incredibly tight chapter one, chapter two across titles sort of a thing, but what happens in one issue of one title is impacting the others, and they're feeling the reverberations of it. So you can tell they're all set in the same world at the same time, and different things are going on. So I think their approach to doing essentially what CrossGen did at one point with The Forge, The Edge, and I forget what the other ones were, where it's basically, okay, here's the first issue of all the mutant books in one collection, here's the second, here's the third. I think that's an interesting approach and could work. I would expect them to circle back after the first arcs and then just do, here's the first arc of X-Men versus Marauders versus, you know, Excalibur.
Right.
But I think there's enough connection and cross-continuity that doing all the first issues together is not just a random cash grab.
Yeah, and that's really what it takes. I mean, you can't say the same about a lot of the DC stuff right now. They're just, you've got characters doing different things in different books in the same timeline. So it does take an attention to what you're putting out there and an intention to what you're doing as well.
Yeah, I definitely think this is Hickman having a game plan and coordinating with the other creative teams and such. And so far, it's generally paying off, because there's one or two titles where I'm thinking, if this were truly totally standalone, I'd probably dump it. But because there's enough cohesion in the X corner of the universe right now, I may keep it. So I think they're doing some good stuff there.
Yeah.
That being said, I'd be surprised if you see that twos collection or threes collection. DC did this. It's done it several times. The New 52s, they put out an omnibus with all the number ones. They did the same thing when they used to do that 1 month Like they did the 0 year one. They did the villain one.
They do that for special stuff. Yeah.
I'd be shocked if Marvel does a number twos collection.
I think it is conceivable. I certainly don't think it's guaranteed. So I agree with your concern there. To me, the difference is we're talking, what, six titles versus, you know, 52 or something in those cases you mentioned for DC.
No, I agree.
These actually have some connection story-wise, whereas the DC ones generally never did.
No, I don't disagree with any of that. I'd still be shocked if it happens.
To me, what would shock me is not if it happens, but if it continues to work. If they can get this to where they've got a collection of 2, 3, and 4, and it's still working that they keep doing it after that, they've done something right that would be great and, frankly, a little surprising.
Yes.
Yep. Agreed.
So we'll see what direction they go and you know, what the audience reaction is. So one of the things I did this time as I was going through the Excel file, put my article together, whatever, is I highlighted the publisher, the first entry for every publisher in green. Top-selling Marvel book this time. We talked about X-Men. We talked about the top Marvel one, top Image one for Spawn. DC was Joker, Year of the Villain. We've got to go a ways down to get another publisher that's down at rank, I think, 50 with Vengeance of Vampirella from Dynamite. So it does go and show, again, unsurprisingly, Marvel and DC are taking a lot of stuff at the top of the list. That's just the way it goes since they've got such a strong foothold in the market. We did have a couple of titles where we saw some pretty massive drops. I don't think any of them are particularly shocking. One of the larger ones was down at rank 33 on Marvel Comics 1001, which dropped by, 75.72%. But 1001 was kind of a different thing than 1000, and 1000 was kind of a unique thing to begin with. So, gee, it went down. Go figure, you know?
Yep. That's not a shocker.
No. Then we also had one that was, I think, the largest one on the list, was way down, which was an 84.55% drop on Bloodshot number 2, down at rank 295, having gone from the 44,615 on the first issue down to 6,891 here on the second issue.
Yeah, so the reason that you saw that was the first issue was fully returnable. There was a 1 in 250 carbon fiber cover, and Cowabunga was one of, I think, 25 or so retailers that did exclusive covers. And those exclusive covers get counted into the list because they count towards the 1 in 250 carbon fiber.
Yeah.
So it all wraps in, and that's why.
This is the kind of thing, though, if you're looking for books to flip, this second issue might be one to look out for, because when that movie comes out, it may generate enough interest that people are interested in it. The number ones are fairly ubiquitous, whereas this is a much smaller availability.
Right.
And I Not think that's that I'm why... suggesting anyone flip books. I'm just saying if you're gonna, you know, pick wisely.
Yeah, and I think that's why you're seeing some of the more, what's the best way of saying it? Some creators who play into that a little bit, and you're seeing them create new characters in like second and third issues, Donny Cates being one of them. Kind of as a way of saying, yeah, you can go ahead and sell this Venom number one, but Venom number three is the one where the first appearance shows up. And by that time, only the diehards are really buying it, or the handful off the shelf. Then it goes back to press and it becomes a huge thing. So, you know, if you've got a good creator who also can tap into that, it's another way of making sure your title stays relevant by keeping people having to come back, because that number one is a number one, but it's flooded. So really, you want those special ones.
Do you think those creators are doing it to sort of reward those people who get those second or third issues, or as a way to game the system to I don't say inflate the sales, but to beef up the sales, legitimately story-based, so I respect that.
I think it's a mix. I think most of them would do it from a standpoint of reward as opposed to artificial inflation. And the reason I say that is because the artificial inflation only counts if people have enough heads up ahead of time to know that there's going to be something in there to order it by. Because by the time reorder and stuff like that comes around, you've really missed the momentum swing. Now you're just trying to play catch up. Whereas with all of the big variant covers and the ratios and things like that, you're trying to pump the numbers up ahead of time and hoping the extras will be sitting on the shelf. So I think it's really more of a kind of a value to the reader than it is trying to juice and game the numbers.
That makes sense to me. I think anything that's coming out of the mind of the writer, hey, if I do this here, it will be more interesting, it'll get more attention, it will sell better, is kind of coming from the right place with the right intent. Versus after the thing's already done, hey, if we slap this hologram on it or do this kind of crazy cover thing, regardless of the content, it will do better, you know. But we've seen just so many gimmicks these days, it's easy to get a little jaded. The other one that I found interesting at rank 22, and yeah, I'm bouncing around a little here, is Spider-Man number 2, 61,261 units. That's down 112,395 units, which is 64.72%. Unsurprisingly, people were very excited on the first issue of J.J. Abrams and his son Henry's, you know, take on Spider-Man. Less interested in this. Again, no doubt that's also a reflection on just how much Marvel tends to promote first issues versus second issues.
Yeah, and you had a whole bunch of variant covers and all of that good business, so.
Yeah. I think these days, if it's a Marvel comic, it's more than likely to have variant covers. If it's a Marvel first issue, it's guaranteed to have a plethora of them, and that's just how they do business.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to say I'm overjoyed by it, but I acknowledge that's how it is. I at least don't find that as somewhat annoying as DC's kind of cardstock cover at the different price points, just because, again, that kind of, you know, has impacted how I've got to do the number crunching. And I don't know that they're really seeing the kind of benefit out of that that would make it worthwhile, in my opinion. Of course, an argument can be made, anything that increases sales at all is worthwhile, and there's a rationale to that. If we go a little further down on the list, we start getting past rank 100 and stuff. This is where we're starting to see things like the Dollar Comics from DC. Obviously, we've got some of the True Believer stuff that Marvel's had great success with over the years. We're also starting to see the first issues of some of the latest round of DC Giants. We've got the DC Villains Giant, the Flash Giant, the Wonder Woman Giant, the Swamp Thing Giant. Further down, the Aquaman Giant and the DC Ghosts Giant. These are doing between like 15,300 down to about 10,800. They're predominantly reprints with, you know, a new story in them. So, you know, I think it's good they're finally getting this sort of thing available to the direct market.
I still think they screwed it all up.
I'm not disagreeing with it. I've stopped getting them myself.
Well, I think they just shot themselves in the foot and they patted themselves on the back for some fake results.
Well, I think the other thing that didn't help this round of them is they were so vague on the solicits.
Right.
There was one or two that if they'd actually put something other than, hey, it's reprints and a new story, and literally that was the solicit, I might have considered picking up like the Crisis Giant they're doing. I mean, I've got Crisis, I've got the Omnibus or the Omnibus or whatever, not the Omnibus, the Absolute of Crisis. I've got the hardcover of Crisis. I don't need another copy of it, but oh, there's new stories. You know, if you told me something about the new stories, I might have bitten on that and gotten it. But when it's basically, hey, it includes, you know, 24 pages of new stories plus classic reprints, and you don't even tell me what you're reprinting or who's doing the new story, you can't expect it to sell great. Now, granted, 10 to 15,000 units? Not bad, doing better than some of their other titles, so maybe they didn't need to put more information in there. But the cost of actually planning those issues out enough in advance to solicit them properly might have been able to bounce the numbers up, I don't know, maybe another few thousand or something. But they didn't choose to.
Yeah.
See, down at this area at rank 151, we get the, I believe, the highest selling Dark Horse, which was Black Hammer Justice League number 4. Down at rank 181, we get the highest Oni Press title of Rick and Morty versus D&D 2 Painscape number 2. That did 13,813 units. Down around, I think it was rank 210. We've got Money Shot number 1, but I think there's also another version of that further down on the list at a different price point.
Yep, there were different price points.
And then the best-selling from Titan was Blade Runner at 214, and then 261, actually, we get Second Coming number 4, the highest-selling for Ahoy, and then Archie versus Predator 2 number 3 for Archie was down at 264. So it takes a little while for some of these publishers to kind of kick in, which is not too surprising. And I'm sure I skipped a few, like Ablaze for Vampire State Building number 1, which is at rank 114, and then I think the second issue was further down at rank 207. It dropped actually by 47.59% on that second issue, But even so, it's still 11,730 units, which for the second issue of a new publisher, not too bad. Not bad at all, actually. Now, one thing I did want to touch on, because I know some people are going to be curious about it, others probably aren't going to care. If we jump to ranks 159, 231, 240, and 245, we've got issues 1, 2, 3, and 4 of Chrononauts Future Shock. This is the miniseries that Mark Millar did for Image Comics that is a sequel to the previous Chrononauts. All four came out on the same day. First issue, 16,522 units. Second issue, again, they were all solicited at the same time also. 10,275 units, so it dropped by over 37%. Third issue dropped by almost 4% down to 9,872 units, and then another percent or so drop on the fourth issue down to 9,758 units. So we see kind of that standard, you know, drop on the second issue, a little bit more on the third, and then kind of leveling out sort of a deal, even though they were all solicited at the same time and all released at the same time. So, I mean, we've always known a lot of this is basically retailer anticipation of how sales are going to play out on the reader side. This is obviously the case because there was zero time for any reader feedback to affect orders for the later issues since they all came out at once.
Yeah, this was not a good experiment.
I don't know why he did this because, I mean, it's obviously going to come out and trade at some point. None of these issues was really the current issue on the rack for any length of time.
It's my understanding that it may have been his final decision, but it's my understanding that this was pushed by Netflix because it matches their binge-watching model of their television shows that they put out. And since they own his publishing world or whatever, or the rights to it, they wanted to do the same kind of release with his books, which actually begs an interesting question of what do the episode views look like when you binge drop things? Is it kind of a similar arc to what we see, or is it more sustained? But anyways, that was the inside scuttlebutt, was that it was all based around the Netflix model, and because his properties are the Millar world or whatever is part of Netflix.
I get dropping the story all at once. I don't get dropping it as four individual issues.
Yeah, if you're going to do that, I think there needs to be something else to go with it. There needs to be a reason to buy it. So if it's, you know, you buy the first issue and you get like a little slipcase for them, or, you know, maybe it's just a TKO thing where you, if you're going to drop them all at once, the first thing you get is you just get to buy all four single issues. It's one item code, you know, it's whatever price. But then you say, if you don't buy these and you wait for the trade's going to be $2 more, $3 more, something like that. I don't know. There's got to be different ways to do it.
Let's talk about TKO for just a second, because you had sent out the order form for the first and second wave of the books.
Yep.
And there was one on the first wave, Sarah, that I had thought about and just never pulled the trigger on. And then there was a few in the second wave I was interested in. But when I was looking at that, where I think TKO made an interesting decision, and I'm sure they thought it through. I saw a presentation the head guy gave in C2E2, I guess, earlier this year. This year, yeah. Guy seemed really sharp, so I'm sure he thought it through. But the price difference on the six individual issues, those were so much higher than the trade. Normally, I would go for the issues, but since I believe they're a little extra tall or just a little odd sized, but it was what was the price? It was a significant price difference between the trade and the issues, where the trade was just so much cheaper. It's like, why wouldn't I go for the trade?
Yeah, I'm pulling up the order form right now just to.
It was like at least a $5 difference, if not like a $7 or $8 difference.
It's a $10 difference. $19.99 cover price for the trade, $29.99 for the six issues. However, I think they're adding some of the value in that, is that you get like a box that the issues go in. So it has an actual kind of protective, nice treatment, you know, nice visual treatment, but nonetheless, correct.
And having seen the box and stuff for the first wave of stuff, because the guy had those in the trades in the panel and stuff, it was nice presentation. I mean, the guy gets high marks for that, but it just seems like they're trying to steer the purchases in a particular direction. I think they're doing the comics so they can say they've done the comics. They're expecting to sell the trades or the hardcovers.
Well, I just think it's interesting because it's not like the comics come out 6 months before the trades.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like you can buy just the issue one. You can read it free digitally, but you can't pick up the individual issues. Either you buy the trade or you buy the six issue box set.
Yeah. and it forces the storytelling to be told in issue chunks if you're going to release them that way, even if you're not going to release them individually that way.
Right.
Yeah, that's not true, though. What comics haven't been told in single issue chunks in 10 years. They take a trade, and they go, oh, that's about 10 pages, chop it off there. 80% of the time, it makes no sense.
I disagree with that. It isn't a good stopping point. They're not telling single issue stories. I agree with that much. However, you're not going to have, you know, out of, say, 6 20-page issues, you're not going to have a scene that goes for, you know, a page and then 2 pages into the next issue. You're not going to split in the middle of a conversation or something. You're going to end on a big moment. So it does have certain storytelling aspects that it forces into the issue.
Fair enough.
Now, your point that they're going to tell their story and kind of cut to their commercial breaks, if you will, for a TV analogy. Yeah, they've been doing that forever. And I think that's unfortunate. But if you know you're going to release the thing all in one chunk, if you go straight for the trade or whatever, it gives you the flexibility to tell the story however you want within that bigger page count. We're already seeing that kind of storytelling shift or whatever in Lazarus with its longer page count and less frequent release. So we're seeing some scenes that Rucka has freely admitted he wouldn't have done if he was doing it in the regular comic size installments. And that's not a right or wrong, it's just, it changes things.
I think the Chrononauts thing, I don't know if I would have, if it was my money, if I would have wanted to take the risk of that release schedule. That being said, I think that release schedule showed, I think, something we kind of intuitively knew. And again, I think it's unfortunately still that collectible mindset. People bought and ordered it not based on wanting the story. They bought and ordered it based on, ooh, it's got a number one on it. Hey, comic readers are just, and retailers are just that Pavlovian. Oh, it's got a number one. It's going to sell 10 times more. Ooh, it's got a number one. I'll buy it.
The only argument I have to that, though, is that as a retailer, when you have to pre-order, if you're forced to pre-order 4 of something, you're not going to order up on 2, 3, and 4 until you know how number one sells. So what I see in the numbers is, by and large, you have, you know, a set number of people buying the entire series, say 10. So your base number is 10. And then you've got a number of people who are going to obviously order up on the number one so that you know for sure you've got some number ones on the shelf for the people that want to come in and try it. And you're going to wane it off from there. If you're like us, you probably say, oh, I know that, you know, Smith, Jones, and Smith 2 are all going to pick this up off the shelf, even though it's not on their pull list. So what you end up doing is you end up creating this graduated scale where maybe 10 is your base of who's getting everything. And you kind of do a 20, 15, 12, you know, or something like that, where it kind of just starts to go down. And I don't think it's all around just the number one. Yes, that plays into it. But more than anything, I think it's retailers saying, well, if I put 5 out there, I hope that 3 people will go for number 2 and 2 people will carry on, you know, and get the whole thing. But you're not going to stock. It's foolish because anyone who does it just gets bit over and over again. It's foolish to get 5 of all 4 of them because you're not going to sell 5 of all 4 of them. People are going to get the first and that's it.
I don't disagree with you, but that's my point. The point is, whether you release 1 through 5 on the first day or a month apart, you have the exact same sales.
That I disagree with, because I think
this trend's identical to what we see on most first 4 issues.
I think it is probably better than we would have seen if it had been released over 4 months.
Okay.
Because there would have been time for feedback on the first issue to impact the other ones. Maybe it would have been better, maybe it would have been worse, but it would have at least allowed a more informed decision point. And what we're seeing here, what this is telling me, is the wisdom of the crowd of retailers is saying the average reader is only interested in the first issue. Because the average of the sales on this is 11,607, which is more than the sales of 2, 3, or 4.
Yes, but here's the thing. This is, and again, I think, and I know, I'm not saying it's the retailers that cause it. I'm not saying it's the consumers that cause it, but it's this just generic zeitgeist
that's
in this industry. You track, I bet you track the last 150 issue 1 through 4s, you'll see almost an identical sales trend on all of them. Whether they came out the same day or a month apart or a week apart or 2 months apart, there's something in the numbers that people just go, ooh, it's a number.
Well, yeah, it's because it's the starting point of a story. And you can't, there's no value in having your story at issue 3 when it's the third part of 6, and that being the only thing you have on your shelves. So you have to order up on number 1 to make sure you can sustain the run of that arc. That's why number 1 always has more. It's not always about people going in and buying 3 copies of the number 1 because it's number 1. This is the second volume of Chrononauts. There's little to no value, likely, in buying up number 1s of a second volume. But what you have to do as a retailer is you're not going to get somebody to come off the street the way that comics are written today, pick up number 3 and go, gee golly, this is great, I'm going to keep going. They're not going to, because they know there's 1 and 2 before it. So yeah, it's a number, but it's also a story writing mechanism that creators use that we have to account for. You go back 25 years ago, and you probably wouldn't see the same trend. Now, granted, you wouldn't see as many number 1s, but you wouldn't see the same trend because those issues were meant to be a singular story. You got the complete story, left you maybe on a cliffhanger or something like that for the next one, but it didn't take 6 issues to tell that whole story. So it's a completely different way of writing that causes a different form of ordering.
I definitely think that that whole zeitgeist of there is this mentality of first issues are going to sell this, then it's going to drop, then it's going to do this. Yeah, I've totally seen the data. It proves that out as to that's what we see, and therefore it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. I do think that, to Eric's point, yeah, the first issue is your entry point, and you want to have that as wide and available as possible, because it's only going to go down from there. People don't want to start reading a book in the middle. They're going to start at at page 1. It's just the way people are.
Yes, but that is something that the industry and the retailers have taught us. Both you and I started, John, never saw a number 1.
Well, let's talk about that, because I was going to say, let's roll back 40 years back to where Brave and the Bold was still going on. And the reason I say that is it ending and starting Batman and the Outsiders, that new number 1 was the first number 1 of a Batman title in decades. That was a big deal. Prior to that point, number 1s weren't needed for jumping on points. You could hop into any issue of the Avengers, the Justice League, the X-Men, the Titans, whatever, and figure out kind of what's going on. Sometimes they were done in one stories, otherwise they were just accessible and pulled you through to the next ones. That's not how stories are being told today. They're in usually very clearly packaged 4 to 6 issue arcs, beginning, middle, and a fairly hard end. So to say that this is something that the retailers or the readers have caused to happen, I question, because I think an argument could and should be made that it's something that's happened because of the way storytellers are constructing the story, and the readers and retailers are just kind of acknowledging that. I think there's fault on both sides.
Again, I'm not going to argue that point. The point is, there is something that has convinced everyone that if there's not a number 1, I can't buy it. And again, John, both you and I'm trying to remember the name of it. I had been reading comics for years before I ever got my first number 1 issue. And I remember it vividly. It was Power Pachyderms number 1, believe it or not, if you can remember that, from Marvel Comics, which I want to say came out in the late 80s. It was written by Roger Stern. Wasn't a great series or whatever, but I mean, literally, that was the first number 1 I ever had in my collection. And I'd been reading comics for, I don't know, 7-8 years at that point.
There was certainly a point at which number 1s were crazy rare. Alpha Flight number 1, that was a big deal over at Marvel.
Yep.
Again, the Batman and the Outsiders, New Mutants number 1, New Teen Titans number 1. There were a couple of things. I mean, there was a point, even in the early 80s, there were a fair number of number 1s back in the 70s with what became the DC implosion of Black Lightning and a few other titles like that. In the 80s, you had All-Star Squadron, you had a Superboy title, I think, you had New Teen Titans, of course, and a bunch of other things like that. So it's not like they were never happening.
Yeah, and those are all slightly before me. And here's a perfect example. Alpha Flight number 1, I do remember when that came out. And I remember not buying it because, A, I didn't have the money to buy that many comics at the time. And 2, I didn't know who they were.
I think that's why I bought it.
But for me, who only had enough money to buy two or three comics, I was going to buy my Amazing Spider-Man 220 or whatever it was, and my Batman 350 or whatever it was, because I'd rather, I knew who Batman was. I wanted another Batman story. I knew who Spider-Man was. I wanted another Spider-Man story. I didn't know who Alpha Flight was. I didn't care.
I guess for me, it was having heard about Marvel, not having read Marvel, liking the look of Byrne's art.
Yeah.
That was one of my gateway comics into the Marvel Universe. Alpha Flight number one and Fantastic Four. Fantastic Four, of course, being an ongoing series that I had dabbled in before. But it's funny because I think there's aspects of the young me that really proves out the concepts that are I think, problematic today. People will read number ones. Well, yeah, I got onto a lot of titles on number ones. It was new and easy way to get in. I also got onto a lot of titles, probably more titles, that were not number one. So there's both sides of that one. But then it was something like, again, Secret Wars, that crossover that got me to branch out to the Marvel Universe. And Crisis, for whatever titles I wasn't already getting in DC, I started getting. But the storytelling style back then was so fundamentally different in terms of the level of accessibility, the return on the investment per issue, than it is now, which is why now I think it's so much a, if you don't get in at the first issue, you're going to write off the volume, you're possibly even going to write off the property.
Yeah, oh yeah, no, and to be fair, it's not just a comic book thing. It happens in novels with novel series now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was a kid, I randomly found and used bookstores various copies of Ian Fleming's James Bond novels. I have no idea what order they came out in at the time. I do now, but that's not the point. I had no idea what order they came out in. I said, oh, it's a James Bond book. And I bought it. And I read it. Television. All the shows I grew up watching, I don't think I necessarily saw the pilot of any of them. The A-Team, the Dukes of Hazzard, whatever. Yeah.
There's an aspect if you could watch most of those shows in almost any order, and it doesn't make that big of a difference.
Yes. And, you know, now you tell somebody, oh, this show's really good. They're like, oh, which streaming service is on so I can go back and watch the first one?
Mm-hmm.
30 years ago, the response was, this show's good. Oh, what night's it on? I'll watch the next one.
But I think, to me, again, that's a reflection on the difference of storytelling. You look at A-Team or Knight Rider or Dukes of Hazzard, you could pick any episode in almost any order, and unless it's one of the arc kind of episodes or whatever, which most of those shows didn't have, it doesn't matter. You're right. Pick it up this week. Pick it up, you know, 6 months ago or 6 months from now. Who cares? Whereas you try to do that today in TV, you're hit in the middle of a story. They're expecting you to know all this stuff. There's an expectation that the audience member, be it a TV show, movie, or comic reader, or novel reader, is more aware of the previous parts of the story that have been told. And I think that's problematic.
Yeah, well, yeah. And that's kind of my point. It's just, and like I said, it's not unique to comics, but it is this odd, oh, we gotta, you know, and I'm just as bad. I'll tell you this, you know, come the first week of the television season, and again, having worked in and around that industry and following it like I still do, there is a here's all the shows premiering, let me record the first several of all of them and watch them. I don't always succeed in that, but that's kind of the goal, or at least mm-hmm. record them all. I didn't used to do that. Never!
I used to do that, and I've stopped.
Fair enough.
I used to be, hey, there's a new season. I want to see all the stuff that looks interesting. I'd go through the TV Guide premiere, you know, issue or whatever,
yep.
See what shows look cool months in advance and plan accordingly. I was the kid who, you know, every year when the comics would have the two-page ad for, you know, ABC or CBS or NBC's lineup of cartoons, because that's how old I am, I figure out what my viewing schedule was going to be. These days, somebody's got to tell me it's worth watching if it's not already on my radar. And I think part of that is just how much is out there to watch or read or what have you.
Well, and I remember, and that was the other thing, you know, again, we're talking the age before VCRs.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when the networks used to run those half-hour primetime previews at all the Saturday morning cartoons. And I was the kid who sat there with a notebook and pen and, like, wrote down all the shows and the times they were on and said, okay, which one do I want to watch at 7? Which one do I want to watch at 7:30? Which one do I want to watch at 8?
Do you think people have that level of interest in comics today? And is it even viable to have that level?
Well, and this goes back to that discussion we were having on the Slack earlier this week about, does continuity matter? Does it not? The, oh, I just want a good story. That's the interesting part. The same people say, oh, I don't care, I just want a good story, won't read issue 400. They only want issue one. Well, which is it? Do you want a good issue or do you want an issue one?
The part of the continuity versus good story aspect that I always find ludicrous is, to me, a good story, history of what's happened in the story matters to the story. Therefore, how could it be a good story if it just plays loose with continuity and disregards it?
I find it interesting that it's the exact same people that say, oh, I just want a good story. That if you say, oh, this series is great, what issue is it at? Mm-hmm. Number 40. Oh, well, maybe there's a trade with the first. I thought you said you just wanted a good story. I'm telling you the next issue is going to be a good story. Yeah, I don't want that one. I only want the one that's got the number one on it.
I get wanting the full context to be able to properly, or not properly, but to fully enjoy the story. But if it's a good story, you shouldn't need that.
Exactly. You're saying over and over again, I don't need the full story. But I won't really start with anything that doesn't have a number one on it.
When somebody says they want a good story, the problem with that statement is what they think is a good story, what we think is a good story, different. Not better or worse, but I have certain things that to me make a story better or worse in my eyes. Other people may not give a damn about that and may care about other aspects.
Do you have any opinion on this, Eric?
Oh, I have no shortage of opinions.
Any you want to share with us?
So, where to even start?
I think issue number one, obviously.
Exactly. Duh. No, I think that continuity does matter from a reader enjoyment and sales mechanism standpoint in two different ways. And I put this on the Slack channel. You can tell a good story that can be out of continuity. What is the Sean Phillips Batman White Knight? Mm-hmm. Whatever it is. Yeah. Great story. Outside of continuity.
It's outside of the mainstream DC continuity, but I would argue it's inside its own continuity, particularly this volume that is playing on the continuity of the previous volume.
Correct. But you could still say it's a great story that can live on its own.
Mm-hmm.
But not a single issue. It requires the whole story. So you kind of run into that issue. But the reason I say continuity matters is because that's a mechanism of how many readers, both of you guys, I'm assuming, and maybe not as many newer readers, but more older readers, continuity is the one thing that kind of got you guys to go deeper and deeper, because there was a consequence that happened somewhere. It was felt in another book, or you were reading about a consequence that you didn't get, so you wanted to go and check that out. Or there was maybe an issue in Spider-Man, say, you know, in the early 100s, and here you're picking up an issue in the late 100s or early 200s, and it references that event that happened 100 issues ago. You want to go back and pick that up. Now, it doesn't have to have continuity to be a good story, but it sure helps if you're trying to sell more books, if you're trying to get more readers hooked, because the continuity piece that connects you to other books is what gets you, like in the case of John, with these X-Men titles, if that continuity is there across the line, and what happens in one book is impacting things in two or three other books, you don't want to miss something, because if you pick one title, you're going to miss what's happening in one of the other three potentially, or your own book is going to suffer because of it. So I think it's important. But when you talk about picking up a good story in today's day and world, in the comic retailer market space, when somebody comes and asks for a good story, if they're asking for a modern comic, we're always starting them at the beginning. And that's just because that's how stories are written. I think that's the way that creators write them. That's the way that editorial sees them. I don't know, you know, how we can break away from that per se, but that is unfortunately the way it goes. The other problem that you have is numbers are numbers for a reason. They're a sequence. And when you are following steps in a piece of IKEA furniture that you get, do you start on step 7 or do you start on step 1? You start on step 1. When you're learning numbers, do you start at, you know, 11 or do you start at 1? You start at 1 and go up. So our culture is just predetermined and predisposed to be starting at number 1. It's a sequence. It's a pattern. It's all those different things. And so what you end up doing is you are surrounded by it all day, every day, that you're just trained mentally to say, well, you know, start at the beginning and go to the end. Don't jump in the middle. If a story's written well enough, you can convince someone to jump into the middle. If you can tell them, yeah, you can pick this issue up. You don't have to care anything about what happened before. You don't even have to care what's going to happen after, but you can enjoy this singular issue. Then it makes a convincing argument. With today's comics, I can't do that. I can't tell you to pick up issue 3 of a 6-issue series. It ain't going to work.
I think there are a handful of titles that somebody could legitimately pick up any issue of, and it is written accessibly enough that they could get in and enjoy that issue as if it were a first issue. And I'm using accessible versus written well because I want to kind of unload some of the terms. One of the examples I'm thinking of is Uncle Scrooge. By and large, most of these issues, and there are a couple where it's a part one, part two, part three, part four across multiple issues or whatever, but a lot of these, you can read any issue, get a sense of who Uncle Scrooge is, Donald, the nephews, and kind of the crux of what's going on. And you could read the stories in almost any order, and it kind of doesn't matter because there's a cohesive general continuity that it all plays into, and not a minutia of continuity where this had to happen before that.
I will agree, and the only thing I will add to that is those books, though, aren't written for a six-issue trade.
Absolutely not.
There are collections of them, but they are more what I would consider to be more akin to something like a newspaper collection, where a newspaper strip, while there are some that connect across days, a lot of the times the newspaper strip was just a quick one and done. And so when you see a package collection of them, they're essentially, you know, it can be a page that is its own standalone story. It can be a singular linear three panel story, you know, whatever it's going to be. So I would consider those a little different, but yes, I agree. And the way that I was framing it was mostly in the big two superhero comics and then our main premier publishers, their main lines. Uncle Scrooge, unfortunately, does not sell nearly as well as some of those things. I would be the first one to jump on the wagon to say that it could sell better because it is of decent quality. They're very entertaining and they're all ages.
Yeah, it's issue 49 is down at rank 398 and it sold 3,145 units. So it could definitely be selling better.
Right.
But I do think there have been some titles that are a little bit more both accessible and not necessarily done in one type stories, but I agree that's not the general order of the day at Marvel and DC. And when you've got things that have a heavy narrative through line and you're getting a snippet of the story versus the full thing, it's hard to tell people to start at some random point.
Right.
But I also remember getting into comics, reading an issue of Superman. Wow, this was good done in one type story. Yeah, there was... It felt like I was catching what Superman did that day, and I knew he did stuff the previous day and the next day, but I got enough of what he did that day to be happy. Reading the letter columns, oh, wow, he did some great stuff 4 issues back. I better go pick that up. There was a point where my Superman collection was like every fourth issue going further back, just because that's what the letter pages, or maybe it was 5 issues, whatever, but that's what the letter pages were referencing, and eventually I filled in some of the gaps. But these days, you just couldn't do that because you do that every 4 issues, or every 6 or whatever, you're getting a random chapter of each arc that's told over the course of the year. And given most stories can get through 2, maybe if they're lucky, 4 arcs in a year, it feels like not as much is happening in the comics versus, again, and I've said this before, and I'll no doubt say it in the future again, over the course of a year back in the 80s, Batman fought a fair number of his rogues gallery. Now, Flash certainly had time to go through almost all of his rogues gallery and stuff, but these days, you're probably still dealing with the same villain for most of the year. You know, it's a slower storytelling style, and I think that makes it harder to get into the middle of an arc because they're not writing for that. Again, like Sam was saying, they're writing for the trades, and that's why if people don't get on board at that first issue, the sales have the standard drop off. Not everybody makes it all the way through a story arc.
Right.
We see the proof of this when we get things like, again, the Chrononauts Future Shock released all at once. I do think when a title, particularly a miniseries, is bulk solicited and released within either a month or, in this case, a single week, certain people are less likely to get it because they feel, and I've heard people say this, that the publisher is trying to push it out there before I have a chance to gauge anything on it and get all my money in advance. You know, kind of they're trying to pull one over on me almost. And I don't know that that's always the intent. There are times it definitely feels that way. And I think that out of almost necessity, the readers and retailers are ordering with the zeitgeist mentality because we've learned. You know, it just doesn't make sense to blindly order on faith, thinking it's just going to be wonderful if it's a series they're cramming out weekly for 5 weeks. Or 4 in 1 month, or in a single week, which again, major exception, but still, if they had enough faith in the material, the mindset is that they would have done it on the monthly basis, given us time to adjust our ordering and buying based on the perceived value of the content, versus trying to get us to commit either at a reader or retailer level, like I said, before we've seen any of it. It's one of the many ways in which the system is kind of broken and favoring the already successful.
Well, but I think it goes back to something I used to say a lot. I don't think I've said it recently on this show, but I used to say it all the time. If you're writing trades, just sell trades. Why bother pretending you're selling single issues when that's not what you're doing?
Well, and Chrononauts Future Shock is a great example of that. They could have released this as a single trade.
Yep.
But I don't think it would have sold the 11,600 or something average that these issues sold. And I think that the downside to that, granted, if it was a trade, I would have gotten it because I like Future Shock or Chrononauts or whatever. If it was a franchise or property I was not so keen on, I might have said, you know what? I'm willing to give a $3.99 sample for the first issue. I'm not willing to do the $19.99 or whatever the trade would have gone for, $14.99 or what have you. Maybe I would have, maybe I wouldn't have. So I do think there's an aspect of perceived reading installment and stuff like that, because if I had gotten that as a single trade and it wasn't something that James and I had chosen to review, which in this case it was, but if it wasn't a trade we had chosen to review, it would probably still be sitting on my stack of trades unread, because for some reason I don't get through my trades as fast as I get through my comics, even if there's an equivalent amount of reading material. It's a crazy psychological thing. So I think by releasing it as four single issues, while I do think it's kind of crazy and they should have gone straight for the trade, I get why they did it, because it gives people the option of, well, we're going to order almost a time and a half as many of the first issue as the last issue. You know, all close to twice as many almost, actually.
Yeah.
It gives that perception of choice.
But even the reader, you know, there's plenty of books that come out monthly. Or now with some of the big two, the every 3 weeks or whatever kind of weird cadence they're on. Where I've heard, you know, in more previously, but I've heard it out of you and I still hear it from James on the weekly. Well, yeah, this wasn't great, but I've already ordered the first three. I might as well get the next couple and finish the arc, see what happens. You know, it's like there's this, like, I'm just going to try the first one. But in actuality, you're really going to try the trade anyways.
It's funny because my reading habits have definitely shifted over the last few years. There was a point where I'll give it the volume. I'm now at the point where, depending how I feel, like Chrononauts, yeah, I ordered all four. I knew I was going to like it. There's other things. I'll order a couple of issues because it sounds good. Like, again, some of the Dawn of X stuff. There's one title in particular not so crazy about. But there's others where I have ordered the first issue and said, you know what, I'm actually going to wait till I get that, read that, and then decide. And by that point, unless it's really good, now it's got the negative inertia to overcome to get me not only to get that next issue, but to actually, you know, hey, Eric, can you get me this previous issue that I missed and skipped because I wasn't sure of, you know? And just it takes effort on my part to do that. And I'm busy, I'm lazy, take whichever you like. And when I've got to go through that level of effort, and it's not just kind of an automatic as I'm going through my regular ordering process, it usually doesn't benefit the title. There have been a couple of titles I have thought about getting and probably would have enjoyed, but just didn't order the first issue, and I haven't read a single one of the run. Black Panther's Agents of Wakanda is actually one of those that it's like, if I'd ordered the first issue, we probably would have reviewed it, I probably would have liked it, and I probably would have gotten the rest. Haven't gotten a single one, haven't read any of them.
Yeah, it is. It's weird. Like I said, there's so many people that, you know, and like I said, you used to be one of them. You're no longer one of them. But now you've gone to the, I don't want to say opposite extreme, but almost opposite extreme.
No, that's fair.
Like, well, I'll order one, but like you said, once you order one, sort of cat.
It is harder for a title to get on my list now than it used to be.
Yeah, and what you just said, though, is, not only is it harder for a title to get on your list, even if it gets on your list, you haven't already pre-ordered the first three before you get the first one. So now, not only do you have to like the first one, in the old days it was, well, I didn't absolutely hate the first one, so I might as well order four and five.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's, I didn't love this, so I'm not going to go through the effort of tracking down two and three.
Well, and I've got a couple of titles that, as I was starting to look at the December information, There's a couple of them where I'm actively reassessing, do I still get this title? I never used to do that. That does not help these numbers we're looking at go up. It helps them go down. And DC in particular got themselves into this position between things like the DC Giants and a couple of what I felt were misfires on events and stuff, and a general lack of cohesion in the DC universe, and now a looming potential reboot. It really has me less excited about this stuff. And it's gotten to the point where it used to be pretty easy to pick a Marvel or DC in another book with my co-host every week, because it's like any Marvel, DC, and almost, you know, half the other books, yeah, it's fair game, whatever. And now there are a couple of times that James and I, it's like, well, yeah, I don't know what we're going to do for one of these slots. It's just a small week for what I'm getting from Marvel or DC or what have you. And I certainly expect any particular reader and what the publishers are doing, that the alignment of that level of interest of what they're doing and what the reader wants, be it me or somebody else, sometimes will be in perfect alignment, other times diametrically opposed, or somewhere in between. That's just a natural evolution. But it just seems like, and certainly I've gotten, you know, jaded as I've gotten older, I've got other things going on in my life too, I'm finding myself less excited about some of these things, and I look at these sales numbers and think, I'm not the only one. You know, when we've got like the Nightwing annual selling 16,369 units, Nightwing used to be a fan favorite character. Not to say it was necessarily at the top of the charts, but that's not great sales, you know?
It's also not Nightwing.
That's true.
That's very true.
When we get to the regular issue, we're up to about 20,000, 21,000, but still, it's not Nightwing. Is it because that people weren't reading Nightwing and didn't care about Nightwing, or because the creators decided to make a shift, or the publisher made a shift? What's the cart, what's the horse? What's leading the charge on this? Am I feeling I'm less excited about this because they've changed the character? Do they change the character because they thought I was less excited about this? Or we were less excited about this? I certainly don't think anyone at DC is paying attention to what I'm saying on the podcast and changing their publishing plans accordingly. Or if they are, they're doing it wrong.
I highly doubt it, because we have retailers and us ourselves talking directly to them, and that's not making a difference. So no offense, John, but if they're not listening to us right in their faces, they're probably not going to listen to your podcast to get their ideas.
Well, I do know that people listen to the podcast at the various companies. I've clear evidence of that. I'm not going to say they like or agree with what I say, but that's their right. I have been at San Diego one year, introduced myself, and got a, I know who you are, kind of, I don't say dismissive, but less than positive response, we shall say. Of course, that was nature for that particular individual, I think, so I didn't take it too personally, still. But, you know, with the looming rumors of this 5G thing of we may get a different Batman, a different Superman, etc., are they doing that because of how sales are, because they think people need something else? I mean, what is motivating some of this, and what are the ramifications going to be? Are people not excited about some of the current things in comics? Because, again, I remember after Crisis hearing a number of creators, well, that's not my Superman. I get it. We're like four Supermen past that. So it's hard to hook in on a character and identify with that character when every time they get a new arc, a new story, or whatever, they've shifted to a fairly different story angle. And not to say they're bad stories, but this comes down to, how do you define continuity? Are you talking the minutia of the day-to-day? Well, he was wearing this yesterday, he's wearing this today, oh my god. Or are you talking the basic crux of the character? And even then, how do you define that basic crux? You could argue the character of Tony Stark 16 different ways. A valid one of those is this futurist mentality of him, and this whole arc they're doing in the Tony Stark Iron Man comic of, you know, artificial intelligence rights, and is Tony real, or is he kind of a simulation of himself or whatever? You know, has he done so much over the years that he's no longer who he was in a very real sense? Very interesting arc, but an almost unrecognizable character to the Tony Stark I had originally read back when I first got into comics, and many of the ones in between.
At least his name is Tony Stark.
That's true.
I think that when you start taking characters out, now we've all seen Batman. Dick Grayson was Batman for a little bit. When it's something where it makes sense, it's logical, and it's usually forecast it to not be an never-ending ongoing change, you can kind of accept some of it. We've seen it completely backfire with Falcon as Captain America, Jane Foster as Thor, although Jane Foster did kind of turn the corner at one point, but it was part of that whole, why are you changing the heroes completely? I think part of the struggle is, if you're going to change it, it's okay if it makes sense in context of the story. But to just line-wide change everybody, new Superman is a different, you know, a completely different named person, Jonathan Kent, maybe, whoever. New Batman, completely different named person. I mean, when you go through and you do that, then it is a completely jarring event where people can go, well, it's not Bruce Wayne, it's not Clark Kent, it's not, you know, Diana or whatever. Why do I need to be around now? I followed these characters. I don't really care anymore. And that's what they run the risk of. We've had some customers come in who have been, you know, saying, well, I hear DC's going to do something new. I wonder what it's going to be. We've had some people come in that have said, I heard that DC's going to get rid of all their main characters, and I really don't plan on keeping their books, so you can just go ahead and stop my subscriptions now. And that's true. It has happened in our store where people are already stopping their subscriptions. And that's, it's terrible because there's so little, so vague of information of what's coming that we as a retailer can't just stand up there and say, oh, well, no, just hold in there. There's nothing yet because we don't know, but it's just ridiculous.
I think there's a couple of things at play there. There's the lame duck title aspect that DC had before with the lead up to Flashpoint. And that got a lot of people saying, well, you know, they're ending everything in a few months, so why should I even bother finishing out this arc or whatever? Which I thought was a little draconian, but, you know, I get it. But I think they also lost some credibility with how they marketed the New 52. It's the equivalent of Superman working for the Daily Star versus the Daily Planet, or the yellow oval behind the Batman. We're not doing a wholesale reboot. We're just retooling a few things. We're rethinking storytelling. That's exactly what John Rood and Bob Wayne told me to my face at San Diego that year before the relaunch and stuff, as they were trying to control the narrative. And then what we got was a complete and utter reboot of the characters, to the point of, you know, Supergirl crash landing to Earth for the first time yet again. So it's hard to not fear they're going to throw the baby out with the bathwater with a 5G reboot if that's what they're going to do. And to your point, we just don't know. But in the context of the sales numbers, let's suppose they do that. My expectation is we may see some sales drop off leading up to that, as we've got the perception of lame duck titles. The launch of it would do really well for DC that month, possibly the next, as people are sampling things and saying, oh, wow, I'm excited, it looks good, or I'm cautiously optimistic, or whatever. For all the people who say, hey, I'm out, there's going to be others who say, hey, I'm in for the moment. But the question is, 6 months later, or whenever it gets to that equilibrium, do we see the same sort of thing that seemed to happen both with the New 52 and Rebirth, where the titles kind of gravitated back down to about how they were for the most part? Not everything was exactly on par, but Superman's going to sell roughly how Superman's going to sell. Sure, maybe Harley Quinn does way better than you would have expected. That's an anomaly. Most things weren't that way. They just have a lot on the line, and for me personally, if they do that kind of, hey, let's replace who's Batman, who's Superman, whatever, I'll go in with an open mind, look at the solicits, see who there's putting out for sample art and story and stuff like that, and say, okay, I may sample some of this, I may try it, but they got to win me over. Because at that point, I'm going to have been going through the entire... I mean, I started pre-Crisis, was mostly all in from Crisis through Flashpoint, you know, after that through New 52 to Rebirth, and it started dropping off of late. But when it's like, this is my third time around on the merry-go-round, I think I've figured out the pattern, you know, kind of thing. And to me, it's a matter of accessibility, a matter of respecting high-level continuity, and above all, respecting the readers. That's where I think a lot of these companies have gone wrong. Even when they're telling good stories, do we need yet another Doctor Strange number one, another Captain America number one that we seem to get every few moments? They're going for the easy sell. They're not winning us over as long-term readers. And I think part of it is they've forgotten how to do that. If they ever actually knew, or just maybe in the past, they were just able to do it through gut instinct, and those people have moved on and aren't the ones writing and editing the stories these days. You know, you look at a lot of these sales, and I don't know, and we've talked about this before, where would you consider good sales to start or whatever? And the reality is, most of these books are well below that, you know. And I think it's a different benchmark of good sales for Marvel DC as for everybody else. You know, I think it's a higher level for Marvel DC. But it's one of those things. We had some stuff at the top of the list that sold really well. We had a number of things that were over the 100,000. A fair number of things that were over, say, that 70,000 thing. I mean, less than 18, but still almost 18. We've got so many of these things that are just middling sales. And I don't see anything that will really change that dynamic on a meaningful and less than transient basis, or more than transient basis, if you know what I mean. In other words, yeah, you get an event, okay, you lift the boats for a little bit, then the event goes down, tide washes out, and you're back where you were. Do you have something? Can a 5G sort of event get more than 40,000 people interested in Action Comics, in Green Lantern, in Justice League, in Detective Comics? And granted, some of these are probably doing better when you add in the different price points, but you get what I'm saying. A lot of these things are just not moving many units. I mean, Wonder Woman's selling, you know, under 30,000 units. Is she the most popular character? Probably not. I remember when the store I was working at as a kid sold 3 copies. One to the store owner, one to me, and the other sat on the shelf.
Sold to the shelf.
Yeah, I distinctly remember that because one of the times I was helping the owner, it's like, well, how many should I order of Wonder Woman? You should order more. It's a great character. He's like, how many do I have on the shelf for the last, I think it was like 8 issues, and it was one of each. And he's like, I've ordered 3. I bought one. You bought the other. There's the third. Should I get more? No, you shouldn't. Got it. Okay. You know?
The numbers say no.
Yeah. That the store owner, Chris, was really was patient with me. I was young. But very educational process. I loved working there. Great guy. But we're at a point where Wonder Woman's actually got, you know, some movies doing pretty well, and they can't do better than 30,000? I don't know.
Especially in a day and age where I think consciously the culture is keeping an eye towards empowering women, finding ways to call out their successes. Not that women are dependent on that, but for many years we didn't see that. We may not have heard it. And I think all of us that have experienced a mother in the house, whether she worked, whether she was at home all the time or whatever, women are amazing and should be celebrated. And so I think at this day and age where we're starting to celebrate women more, it's a golden opportunity to be able to showcase, you know, Wonder Woman, who, as far as I'm concerned, has one of the absolutely most beautiful stories of how she became to be, depending on which one you go to. But if you go back to the original one, just a statue became flesh, basically out of a mother's love of wanting a child and all the things that she's done over her existence. I think that that's a character that just has so much. It's a shame that she doesn't sell better than she does. And a lot of it is because in the past, even from her original creation, she was treated as kind of a vanity project. You know, we've got some very famous, very expensive early appearance bondage covers. We've got everything from the hypersexualized, points in some of the 80s and 90s books, and even some of the early 2000s. So we've seen where we can go with it, but it's still a character that has so much promise and hope and potential that it should sell better just for what it is, not because of any one thing or another, but because it is a strong female that is a role model for a lot of young girls. My daughter absolutely loves Wonder Woman. She's 5, so she's obviously not reading, you know, the current run of Wonder Woman, nor do I think she would maybe necessarily get into it, because my wife was reading it and has recently just said, I can't stand this anymore. But, you know, that's a character that should be able to do better.
I agree with that, but I think it's what the character can be, not what the character currently is in the comics.
Agreed.
Because everything you were saying about female empowerment and the basis of what is underlying of the character there could absolutely do better if it was written in the right direction and marketed in that kind of a vein. Whereas, I mean, the current arc has been dealing with love literally being dead.
Right.
And so much of this volume has been kind of almost the romance and stuff between Wonder Woman and Steve Trevor. And it's like, do we really need this to boil down to, I don't say boil down to a romance book, because that's not accurate. But wouldn't it be a better way to handle it if you were to treat Wonder Woman and this military man of Steve Trevor as soulmates that are obviously she's a superhero. He's just a regular, you know, super soldier and
a regular hero.
A regular hero. But if they were soulmates and they were peers and not this, are they dating? Are they not? Are they breaking up? You know, not that aspect. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a way to treat them as equals that empowers both sides of the relationship without making it around, you know, can they be together? Can they not? And again, the overt romance angle that doesn't need to be there. And they could, I think they could reposition the title and the character in a more successful direction than they have been.
Yep.
I don't think it'd be trivial to do, but I think if they could lock on to that, they could really take the character to the next level. But I think it's systemic at, certainly at DC, of not understanding how to handle any of the characters.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not just an indication or an indictment on the Wonder Woman work. It's line-wide, but that's one example.
Yeah. I would say the one place where I think they're doing some of the best work in terms of getting the right take on the character is really a lot of what Bendis is doing, both personally with the Superman stuff and some of the other stuff in the Wonder Comics line.
Mm-hmm. And you're going to have your weaker issue or your miss here or there, but by and large, he has been the steady Eddie, the solid creator.
Yeah. So we'll see where they go. I wonder how these sales are going to look 6 months from now when the Dawn of X titles have gotten past their first arc. If and when we ever hit kind of a 5G reboot or what have you over at DC. Because we're seeing that titles can sell well, they can launch well, but most of the time they just don't.
Right, right.
And certainly we got a ton of titles. I don't expect everyone to be a top seller, but I expect them, for the most part, to be able to do more than the 20, 30,000 units so many of them are struggling to do. But, you know, we'll see what happens. Typically, at Q4, we see some decent sales, but Q1, not so much. So really, it comes down to, are we seeing stuff in the current solicits that are indicative of a really good first quarter, or really, it's going to be okay at best.
Marvel should have at least a pretty strong start to the first quarter with Star Wars #1 coming out January 1st, as well as the new Thor and the new Hawkeye. Obviously, Star Wars will most likely pace the field in that, at least on that release week. But yeah, January, February are always the doldrums, and I think that's felt along a lot of lines of retail, especially when it's disposable income retail, because you're coming off the holiday high, and
yeah,
you know, everybody's got to pay off the credit cards or whatever it is. So,
well, two thoughts on that, particularly the Star Wars #1 and Thor #1. Those are both items that kind of were in the previews, Marvel previews catalog, but not in the order form. You had the FOC thing. So I think there's some potential ordering minutia that could potentially trip those up a little bit. Hopefully it won't. But even if that doesn't cause problems, those are going to do good first issues, but then how are they going to do on that second? Are we going to see drop-offs? I haven't looked at how many variant covers those have.
Star Wars definitely had plenty. Thor had plenty. Hawkeye only had, I think, two or three, maybe two.
Yeah, it's about all I would expect.
Absolutely ridiculous how this whole thing worked out, because we've got books that we had to FOC before the initial order is due for the catalog that people could first see them in.
Yeah, that...
So...
And I know I was joking with Sam about this earlier and stuff. I mean, I get how, you know, Christmas and New Year's could catch people by surprise. It's not like these are scheduled events.
Right, right. If only they could be on the same day every year.
I know.
It's like the 4th of July. You just never know where it's going to land.
I know. You could put these things on the calendar and make it predictable or something. You know, not one of these where you got to do the math between how many days from the first of the year to the end of the year to the middle of the year to get to the first of the year when New Year's is. I don't know. I'm one of those people who try to plan a little ahead. So when the publishers seem to get caught flat-footed on that, it seems like the ball was dropped on multiple levels.
Yep.
But this goes back to another point I've made for years. These are retail items. Retailers, in theory, order these. You guys have had more than enough time to order them, know about it, find out about it, make your adjustments. This idea that, ooh, I couldn't take these and get pre-orders, still is frustrating to me. How many people do you have that want Star Wars? You should generally know that if you're a retailer.
Unfortunately, in this market, you can't know that because of how titles recycle, of how creators change. I mean, it's tough. It is literally tough. If you haven't lived it, I don't think you have an appreciation for it.
it's, I'm not saying that it's so tough that we can't figure it out, because obviously we have our way of doing it. But when your final order cutoff is before order forms are turned in, you really, all you're doing is making a guess. You have no returnability to fall back on. So it's not like you can say, well, normally we get 50, let's just get 100. And if worst case, we can just send them back. You don't get that. You don't have that that ability to fall back on. So you don't have pre-orders finalized. You don't have a cushion to help you return books. You've got sales numbers from previous, you know, a 75-issue run that withered slowly over time, like any good comic series will. You know, how do you just blindly say, oh, go for this number? There's a lot of thought behind it, a lot of work that goes behind it. And there's not a single retailer that went, oh, yeah, FOCing it before, you know, initial orders for the month come in, yeah, that's not a problem. I get it. It seems simple. And yes, you can make some guesses. But gee, when it's your money on the line and you don't have a way to recoup the money, wouldn't you like to just have one of those pieces fall into place for you, so you at least know what your guaranteed demand is? Or if you don't have that, you have the ability to say, well, if I order too much, I can send it back.
I don't disagree with that, Eric. But on the other hand, ultimately, that should be the business. If, and I've said this, we've talked about this, if 95% of what retailers do is go, well, here's what people pre-ordered, I'm just going to duplicate that, Diamond should just open up a mail order service and sell direct. We don't need retailers. What's their purpose?
Literally, but you got to have a starting sheet point
from one to the other.
But you have to have a starting point. I mean, if I have 50 subscribers to Star Wars and then on this new series I get 8, that's a huge piece of information for me. Vice versa, if I have 8 and now I've got 50, that's a huge piece of information. Those are crucial pieces of information to know.
Well, and right now, I mean, Star Wars 72 sold, let's see, on this list, 34,192. Obviously, when that volume first launched, it was around the million mark. So it fell, obviously, over time. But when this new volume's coming out, it's going to be after the Rise of Skywalker movie, which is the end of that trilogy of trilogies. Are people going to have said, you know what, maybe I'm not as keen on Star Wars, maybe they love the film, maybe they don't. How is their mindset going to be based on that? Or are they going to be thinking, you know what? If I want my fix of Star Wars, you know, there's this Mandalorian show on Disney Plus I could go check out. Maybe that's enough for them. Maybe all this is just re-energizing and the sales are going to shoot through the roof. You just don't know. And because they've relaunched these titles so often, yeah, sure, maybe I've gotten every other version of this and I've decided, you know what? I'm done. This is a good jumping off point. Or vice versa. I hadn't gotten a lot of this run. Maybe I'll use it to jump back on. I think there's a ton of variables, and I don't think it's a matter of just retailers are everybody's pre-ordering and they're just copying the numbers and aggregating them. I think that trivializes what retailers do, and the reason we need retailers versus Diamond just doing direct-to-consumer, you know, mail-order sales, there needs to be a place I could go and physically check out the material and say, you know what, I hadn't seen that, I am curious about this. Or to get new readers into the hobby.
I completely agree with all of those things. That being said, every time I walk into a store and I hear the, hey, you know, buy this previews, pre-order, 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 at that point, it's almost like the stores are telling me we don't want you in our stores. We just want you to mail order. Mail order and physically come in here to pick them up.
I think there's a need for pre-ordering, and I get why a lot of people like yourself are not keen on it. But it lowers the risk for the stores, and the margins, I think, are... It's a rough enough market that if they guess wrong, it could be a really big deal.
It ultimately lowers the risk for the subscriber, for the customer. Like, I think part of it is the way that you discuss it and you talk about it. When we have someone come in looking for an issue, or if they grab an issue and we'll just kind of engage them in normal conversation and just say, oh, you know, it's the first time in, new to the area kind of thing. And if they say, yeah, I used to get my comics back home over here, you know, and I just like to come in and grab stuff, and we can just add, you know, casually say, well, there's certain titles that you like to get, because we can just set up a pull list to make sure that we have them for you. If we don't, we always try and order extra, but we just can't guarantee it. And that's, you know, that's the way that we tend to handle it. And more times than not, people go, oh, I didn't know you could do that.
Mm-hmm. It's a convenience factor for the reader.
Right. We don't do it in the light of, I need to know so that I can get enough books. We do it more in the light of, just to make sure that you get what you really want, let us know so that we can have it pulled for you. You don't even have to,
you know, worry about it. And if there's something else that catches your eye, awesome.
Yeah.
For me, when I was shopping locally before doing mail order, and this was, again, 15 plus years ago, it was like the concierge sort of a service. I would have given them at the store what I wanted. I'd go in every week. They would basically hand me what they had already pulled. I'd be able to flip through it, make sure things look good, look on the rack. Oh, there's a couple other things. See what other stuff, you know, caught my eye. And then, you know, be out of there. And it was an efficient use of my time. It actually increased what I would get off the rack, because I didn't have to be spending all my time, oh, did I grab everything, check stuff off my list or whatever. I could actually spend my time looking at the rack for new things, not just the stuff I knew I wanted.
That is how it was for me for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems in the last 5 to 10 years, more and more stores I walk into, there's fewer and fewer signs up that say, hey, here are the new books this week. Hey, here's what we think's cool. That kind of, and more signs, don't forget your previews. Hey, orders are due on this day. It's amazing how many stores no longer look like stores and look like mail order locker depots.
And I get the concern with that. I think that's a valid concern. I'd like to toss that out to the listeners to find out how many of the stores they're dealing with they feel have that sort of a presence or that sort of an issue. Maybe it's just the stores you're dealing with. Maybe it's widespread. I don't know. That's actually one of the things I personally enjoy dealing with Eric Cowabunga as mail order, is it eats up so much less of my time to get my comics. It's nice. But that part of that is just when I was getting stuff, you know, here in town, I'd have to get to the store before it closed, fight the rush hour traffic, spend the half hour or so there, wait in the line to check out, all these kinds of things. And I'm not saying it was horrible. It was a fine experience. But I now have a little more time to be reading and podcasting versus some of that, you know, getting to the store and dealing with it type issues. But if it all becomes that impersonally and it can all be done solely through mail order and there's no purpose to ever go into a physical store, that's bad too.
Yeah.
So was there anything else on the list that you guys found particularly interesting that you want to talk about real quick?
It's not on the list, but we did have, and Eric, do you want to shed any light on this? On the Slack channel, a lot of confusion came up with what FOC actually is.
Oh, yeah. Good call.
Oh, yeah.
And why you would make a second printing before FOC, and you want to talk about that at all?
Sure. So, final order cutoff. The pre-order cycle has a couple of different milestones. The first one is initial orders, and the initial order is used to kind of give a measure of magnitude for the companies that utilize FOC to know roughly how big their print runs may end up looking like. Now, there are a number of smaller publishers, a lot of the single title, you know, boutique creator-owned publishing companies, and even some of the ones that have multiple titles running from under other creators underneath them. That initial order is where they set their print run. But for the big two, for all the premier publishers, and for a handful of the other publishers, like your Valiants, your Zenoscopes, Vault, I'm trying to think if there's a couple other ones off the top of my head, but those publishers and then the premiers all do what's called final order cutoff. And usually it's a cutoff 3 weeks to 4 weeks ahead for single issues of when they're going to be released on the shelves. And it can be up to 6 months out for hardcovers and trades on those, just because they take longer to put together. But the final order cutoff is really that last opportunity for retailers to lock in their numbers to make sure that they get what they're ordering. It's a unique thing that Cowabunga does, where we kind of give folks that last 3 to 4 days to really make sure that they have the items that they want. Now, as a store, you can increase and reduce your numbers as you need based on demand. If there's a variant that you think you might want to go for, or you initially think you're going to go for it, and then you look at the other items that are going to be slated on your invoice in those 3 to 4 weeks, and you go, whew, it's going to be a hefty invoice. Maybe we won't take a reach on that one. That's really what FOC is used for, is to kind of lock in and have that as close to for sure what numbers you want. From that FOC number, then the premier publishers and those that use it do the same thing that the smaller publishers that don't use FOC do, and they set their print runs based on what those numbers are, plus their margin of damages and shortages and reorders. So that's really the gist behind FOC.
Now, just to follow on that, that initial order that gets placed was what they used to release Diamond back in 2003, early January 2003 and before, when they were reporting essentially on pre-orders. So the order form came out, people said they wanted this, they got it, they summed that up, and they said that's what the sales were. The problem with that was a couple of things. First off, anything that was solicited and never came out, well, you've kind of reported sales for, and that doesn't seem right. And it also didn't include things like the final order cutoff type stuff or advanced reorders. So again, in February 2003, they shifted to invoiced sales. That's what we've got today. So the numbers we're seeing here are what was invoiced to stores in October. So that includes all the initial orders, all the FOC orders, and the advance reorders, which are after FOC and before the item comes out, plus any first month reorder activity. So if something were to come out, say, the first week of October, and stores say, you know what, we need more of this, and they're able to actually get it to the store and invoice it to the store before the end of October, those reorders also show up in these numbers.
Here's where it gets even more fun. If you call in before 4 o'clock Eastern on Tuesday, so if you pay the early delivery convenience fee, if you call before 4 p.m. on a Tuesday, there's a good chance that you could get your books the next week, your reorders, your damages, mm-hmm. your shortages, whatever. So the data may actually show some week 1, 2, and maybe a couple of week 3, but highly unlikely because usually the invoice lags by a week on that. But certainly week 1 and week 2 reorders as well.
Yeah.
All sorts of fun things to deal with Diamond.
I mean, I'd love to see this data broken down to a weekly kind of a thing. I don't think they're ever going to do it, but I'd love to have that data.
Sure.
So then that becomes the question. What you just said was the big two set their print runs after FOC.
Yep.
Generally speaking, there are a few exception cases when they have to do like the, what was the crazy covers they did?
The yeah,
lenticulars.
Yeah, but they had an early FOC for those.
Yep, same with the acetates. It was an early FOC.
Not the first time they did those, but yes, later they realize what the lead time is and do accordingly.
Oh, were you thinking of the new 52, like 23.1, the Joker, and that kind of...
The first time they did the lenticulars and they had to allocate.
Yeah.
So now comes the question that was the big topic on the Slack channel. Why, if you haven't set your print run yet, would you announce a second printing other than anything as a marketing shenanigan?
So, I shouldn't say never. I can't recall seeing a second print announced before the first print ever hit FOC and was done. I have seen, second prints announced days after FOC's close because, people miss FOC and they start calling for reorders and those publishing like Monday is the last day you can possibly get those numbers in because Tuesday the printers are starting the process of printing those books and they've got it set.
Again, so, all of that makes sense.
So if people are calling on Tuesday, there's only such a small percentage of stock that is saved for reorders, damages, and shortages.
Yep.
That if Marvel starts seeing that a title is getting more reorders on Tuesday or Wednesday and they don't have enough stock to actually handle it, but there's enough demand, they'll go ahead and fire off, you know, a note saying, hey, we're rushing it back to a second print. Alternatively, one of the things that Marvel will do as well is they will know, based on the content of their books, that, oh, there could be a first appearance here. Great case in point would be Captain Marvel number 8, I think, is the first appearance of Star. They knew that her first appearance was going to be in that book. So as soon as they started to get a sniff that the reorders were coming in, they immediately called a second print of it because they knew there was going to be a significant amount of demand. There are some other instances in the case of House of and Powers of where they can look at the trend lines as you get to issues 2 and 3 and start to say, holy cow, you know, the print runs are going higher on FOC. We're going to have to add a 3rd, 4th, 5th print. So it's really all in just reading the reorders and how they come in. Now, I will say there's one company that will pull the trigger really quick on doing subsequent printings, and that's Marvel. And they'll give you a new cover each time, which is a tool that retailers have that makes it more palatable than what DC does. But it does also create an additional quote-unquote collectible that people will potentially come in even if they bought the other covers because they want to be completists. What DC does is very different. They force you to enter reorders into the system, and they will not reprint until the reorders hit a specific number. The problem with that is those reorder numbers could trickle in over the course of weeks, months, and in one case, over a year. And once they hit this magical threshold number, then they'll fire off another print. Well, what happens when you do that is when you submit a reorder and it's out of stock, you're automatically defaulted to saying when that printing is reprinted, if it's reprinted, you will for sure buy the amount of copies you put in. So DC has in the past shipped almost a year or more later a dozen books to retailers that they had put in as a reorder a year back thinking they were going to get a subsequent printing. And now all of a sudden they've got this book that is a year out of date. It's so stale, it's not going anywhere. So you have to be careful in how you do that. Marvel plans more to the side of we'd rather have extra books on the shelf than not, whereas DC is kind of this weird thing of we'd rather guarantee we're only going to print certain amount. I don't know. It's kind of weird how they do it. But Marvel, they are quicker to pull the trigger on subsequent printings because they know their books right now are more in demand.
You've still danced around the question.
Well, the answer was I've never seen one FOC'd before another one is finished. Like, I've never seen a second print hit FOC before a first print hit FOC.
Exactly, which means ultimately it's just a way to get another variant cover on this book without any actual demand or need for a quote-unquote second print, right?
Well, no, they don't do it. So they don't do the second print until they know there's demand for it.
But I thought, wait a minute. Well, I'm trying to remember, what's the issue we're talking about when this came up?
I think there was a specific issue, was there?
There was. There was one specific. And
there was one that was mentioned on the Slack channel. I forget what it was, but
where Marvel announced the second print before the first issue's FOC. And that's when everybody went, wait a minute, I thought they sent print runs with the FOC. What's going on here?
And again, like I was saying, generally they do, but there are a couple of cases where they'll jump the gun on that for whatever reason. Sometimes it's a cover gimmick. Other times it's, I'm not sure exactly what it would be. But you were mentioning demand on some of the books. I did want to mention House of X, Powers of X. Every issue of both of those titles was on the list this time around, many of them under 300. But we had like almost 10,000 units of House of X number 4 in terms of reorder activity. So these things have been doing pretty well, and if that gets them some extra printings, that wouldn't be the least bit surprising. And again, it sets it up potentially very well for the collected edition.
Right. I'm trying to scan back and see if I can find out the issue so we can actually look at it. Okay, John, you got a vamp. We're going to race to see if we can find it.
Well, while you guys are doing that, I'll talk real briefly about the price points. Lo and behold, $3.99, still the most popular price point. Who'd have thunk it? It's about 70% of both the top 300 and the top 500. Next most popular is $4.99. That's about 21% of the top 300 or 17.8% of the top 500. And then $1 and $5.99 are the other price points. There's just not as many price points in the top 300 as there used to be. That's a good thing. Problem is we're starting to see some of the $7.99, $9.99 type stuff. Which I don't think anyone's really in favor of, but sometimes they give us the value for the money, so it's not too bad. So did you guys find it yet?
I'm getting really close.
I am. I'm finding the discussion, but I still haven't gotten back to the beginning to find the issue we're talking about.
See, and I'm coming back to the off-the-panel number 221 with Hibbs.
Yeah.
This is one of the things where maybe we should have a thread on the forum where it's a little easier to go reference after the fact of people just putting... Not a full discussion, but here's the question they want us to address in these these episodes.
Oh, yeah, I'm getting really, really close to this here. Okay, hold on. Incoming.
Incoming.
Already on a second print.
Yep, there you go.
All right, so incoming number one. Just jot some notes here as I talk. FOC was 11/18. Ship date is 12/25. This could just be a holiday thing that they had to rush it because of the whole same piece, but I'm not even seeing a second printing yet for this listed.
I would have expected the FOC to have been December 4th if it's a December 25 thing, but two weeks before that seems a little early for an FOC.
So here's exactly what happened. It's exactly what I described. The initial FOC for number one was 11/18. The FOC for the second print is 12/9. So between 11/18 and probably maybe the 25th or the 2nd of December, But not the 2nd of December, we're not there yet. So it had to have been shortly after the initial FOC. Now,
because here's the issue. Go all the way back to the beginning. The second print was announced on 11/14.
Okay.
FOC was on 11/18.
Gotcha.
Why would you do that unless it was simply an excuse to get another alternate cover?
I think it was the cover, but I also think it's because the release date is 12/25, which is Christmas, and then January 8th to get it out as quickly as possible, knowing that they had a screwy schedule for January 1st that pushed the FOC forward for Star Wars, Thor, the other 23 titles or whatever. I think it was just a weird collision of a lot of crap hitting at once. And what they ended up doing was they announced the second printing of Incoming 2. They haven't set a print run for that.
Got it.
That they won't do until December 9th.
Okay.
So where I initially.
So between the 14th and the 18th, you could still only order the first printing.
You could order the second printing in theory, but they are not required to honor that order. They could have canceled the second printing.
Got it.
So they just wanted to get it out there so that it could hit FOC with enough time to be able to hit the printers before the whole holiday kerfuffle.
And I could definitely see where this time of year they need a little bit more lead time as Thanksgiving and stuff like that kicks in and shipping schedules get a little more wonky.
Yeah, at first I thought the whole question was how can you have the second one on FOC before the first one? And
no, it wasn't on. It was announced before the first one FOC was the question.
Yep.
And yeah.
But I could see where if they think they're getting enough orders that they may just say, you know, we're going to cap this at a certain amount and then, you know, do another cover. Because with that other cover comes more interest than the first one would have just gotten on its own.
So this is somewhat similar, but not at all, to Rebirth. So when the Rebirth issue came out and we went to the Retailer Roadshow, we were told over and over again, the first print of this is going to be a $3.99 book. Every subsequent printing is going to be $4.99. Up your orders of the $3.99 copy because everything else will be $4.99. You will sell out of the $3.99.
I thought it was cheaper than that. Wasn't it 99 cents for the first print and then $3 or $4.99?
I don't think so.
Because I seem to remember that issue was extra cheap.
But either way, we were constantly told that was, and that was a book that wasn't at FOC, and they knew they were going to be, reselling. So publishers know what they're doing. They know if it's a good book and it's going to hit, you know, they're prepared for it.
Definitely a good discussion. I think there's at times some confusion around things like the FOC process and stuff like that. And definitely when listeners have questions, I appreciate it when they ask so we can cover them in these episodes. It's what we're here for.
Yep.
So anything else you guys want to talk about?
Nothing off the top of my head, to be 100% honest.
Nope. I got nothing else.
Cool. We've got, like I said, the next set of numbers are going to come out first or second week in December. We'll talk about those, and then after that, we'll get hit up by both the December and the year-end stuff to talk about sometime in January. For some crazy reason, they usually do the year-end numbers before December. Always drives me crazy. But I'm hoping that November looks good and that things end on a decent note for the year before we go into Q1 of 2020. So with that, we'll call it an episode. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening. The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If you differ from your reality, please verify that you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there's at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust and needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month.
In the past, list of top graphic novels in collected editions contained only 50.5 or excuse 10 items. This means that historical data about graphic novels in collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which as far as I know now, has not been successfully met in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales, any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions. They're not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels in collected editions lists, either included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about sales or lack of sales, any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer is here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.